You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and radiocafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. I'm very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Andres Mercado. He is a mobile integrated health officer with the City of Santa Fe Fire Department, and Eric Hickey, who is a mobile integrated health EMT, and Jeff Thomas, who's director of Southwest Care here in Santa Fe. And we're here to talk about my favorite subject, dogs, but also what's going on in the City of Santa Fe health-wise. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So we're actually talking about the partnership among Assistance Dogs of the West, the Southwest Care Center, and the City of Santa Fe Fire Department that has recently acquired a dog to be part of the Mobile Integrated Health Unit. What is the Mobile Integrated Health Program, first of all?
It's more than a program. It's more than a unit. It's more than a set of services. It's more of a change in mentality in how the fire department interacts with the community. The fire department runs about 15,000 calls a year, 911 calls a year, and about 80 to 90% of those are for medical and health reasons. The system that we currently have is really good at addressing episodic care, heart attacks, strokes, people hit by cars, people falling off of ladders, but that's a small percentage of the calls we're actually responding to. The majority of the calls we're responding to are for individuals that have a hard time navigating the healthcare system, individuals that are suffering from preventable conditions or preventable injuries such as falls, individuals struggling with substance abuse and mental health issues. So mobile integrated health is a nationwide concept that's taking hold that is essentially asking fire departments and EMS agencies to consider what a system would look like if we could design it from scratch, starting from the beginning, taking the current demands on the system, and instead of applying the old model, really designing it from the ground up in a way that's responsive to the community needs and meets the mission of protecting life safety through emergency response and prevention.
One of the things that's sort of interesting is that there's kind of like no fires anymore. What's going on with that? Is just the fire codes are so good?
Exactly. So our, you know, the fire codes coupled with fire prevention has really, again, prevented any, or I should say many, of the fires that used to consume homes and structures from even getting past perhaps a smoking stage.
Right.
So you're from Boston.
Well, I've lived there anyway.
Okay. Well, you've lived in Boston, and Boston, Houston, Chicago. I mean, they used to have fires that would consume an entire block. Three walk-ups, and you'd have 14 people dead. But the nation got tired of that, and they came up with sheetrock and fire sprinkler systems and hydrants and automatic closing doors and hardwired smoke alarms. And so, yeah, the prevention efforts have been terrific. It's really not just been the fire department, but an entire industry. The fire department didn't come up with sheetrock, for example. But the cross-sector push for prevention has gotten it to the point where I believe we have about a dozen structure fires a year here in Santa Fe out of our 15,000 calls. So they still happen. You still need a strong firefighting force to deal with them when they happen. We have a huge threat to our watershed from wildland-urban interface, and the city has dedicated some resources to preventative service lines for wildfire. So fires are still something that we live with and something our department needs to be ready to respond to. But, you know, this whole concept asks us to say, you do have to respond to fires, so make sure you have that ability in place. But not everything we have is a fire. So what's the right system design? I mean, have a conscious and deliberate process to design the system, which takes all hazards into consideration, including fire, but doesn't skimp on services like mental health services, substance abuse services, prevention services for seniors, et cetera.
So what's a typical day like when you guys go to work in the fire department? How many calls do you get, and what kind of calls are you looking at?
I may defer to Andres again for that. Me personally, I don't work on the ambulances or the fire engines any longer. I work within the Connect project, and you know, I have a certain set of clients that I visit, and much of the work is self-driven. You know, it's connecting the dots for services for our clients, as well as meetings with the client and meetings with those resources.
It's interesting that you call them clients. I mean, you think of a client as a person who is paying for services in an agency or something like that, but here we're talking about the general public.
Mm. We get our set of individuals that we work with through a very specific means. And I prefer personally to call them clients because I have a more social work and case management interaction with them than medical. I'm not saying that I don't ask for and don't pay attention to medical needs, but my primary focus is connecting them to long-term resources in the way a case manager does.
So when you are working with these folks, I mean, what kind of issues are you working with? I mean, without giving away anybody's private information, but like, what's a typical day like for you? What kind of problems do these clients have?
Some of them have diminishing capacities, and there are challenges with that. So someone who can't make appointments, who can't set up or make rides for themselves, who is non-compliant with their medications, not out of a conscious desire not to do that, but just forgetting to, not having the capacity to truly be regularly compliant with their medications. We have folks who are homeless, folks who are addicted to substances, folks who are, some are housed and some are isolated, and all of the behavioral and medical complications that come from that, from just being isolated, no family, or perhaps their relationship with their family isn't as good as it could be. So they've lost the connection not only to their family, but to the system itself. And so for them, sometimes 911 is the only resource that they can reach out to that they know will respond.
So when you get these calls from people, some of them are regular callers.
Correct.
And so you're basically forming relationships with these folks.
Yeah, so we'll work with a group of folks for 3 months. So 1 quarter worth of, intensive short-term case management. And our hope is to develop a trusting relationship, and then from there build into what their strengths are, what their capacities are, and assist them in their goals, a client-centered, focused intervention.
And we're going to get back to that in a moment, because the dog who is sitting here with us today as we speak here at the Southwest Care Center is part of that. But I wanted to ask you, Andres, what is your day like? I mean, you're doing not just the mobile integrated system, or is that, are you doing the kind of the same thing as Eric?
So I administer the mobile integrated health office. Within the mobile integrated health office, we have several programs. The program that Eric was describing, the Connect program, identifies individuals with concerning patterns of 911 utilization and then provides 3 months of intensive case management for them.
So concerning patterns means they called and said, oh, I have a hangnail, or I fell down, or what's a concerning pattern?
Well, if someone called and said they have a hangnail and they called once and it was a one-off, we don't have the capacity to find those individuals and reach out and provide any meaningful intervention to them. It's more the individuals that are disproportionately using 911 and healthcare services, particularly 911 and emergency room services. For example, if someone calls once a month for 4 months, or someone calls once a week, or someone calls once a day. So it's
do you have those? Do you have daily callers?
Not quite daily, but we do have individuals who, I'll give you an example. We had one individual who spent about 200 days out of the year incarcerated. So they were only out and free about 165 days out in the community where they could call 911. And I think that individual called about 70 times in that year. So that was about every other day of every single day that he was free. So that individual had severe mental illness, was heavily addicted to alcohol. That was a part of self-medication really for his mental illness. So we have folks who call at that rate. It's pretty concerning.
What would he say when he called?
Typically, he wouldn't say anything. He'd be extremely intoxicated, passed out on the side of the road.
And yet he'd had the capacity to call 911.
No, someone would, in the age of cell phones, we'd have, someone would see that individual. This is, it's a big phenomenon in town where individuals who are struggling with mental health issues self-medicate with alcohol and or other drugs, and they pass out on the street and in public places. So then we're called because as drivers drive by, they see someone down on the side of the road and they don't know if the person's dead or alive, and we show up and Oftentimes they're severely altered, and we take them to the emergency room where they can safely detox or safely sober up. And then they get discharged and the cycle begins again.
And you might show up and say, ah, yes, there's Mr. B, whom I've met 73 other times this year. But the real thing is Mr. B, or whoever it is, needs mental health services.
Right.
Are you able to get that person the services they need? Are those services sufficiently available in this community?
Absolutely not. So the name of the program is Connect, and the goal is really to connect people to needed services. But there's an enormous need for more behavioral health services, substance abuse and mental health. And so we do the best within the system that we have, and we advocate for creation of additional services. The Santa Fe County Community Services Department is right now in the execution phase of building a crisis triage center, a crisis center, which is, you can think of it as an urgent care for psychiatric issues. So there's capacity being built. There's a lot of work being done in that arena. But honestly, there's a huge need. There's a lot of stigma. There are a lot of barriers for people who, for Mr. B, typically, you know, if he doesn't make a few appointments, he's labeled non-compliant and he can't come back. Or if he has an outburst in the waiting room, you know, he can't come back. And I mean, bringing it back to the dog, these individuals struggle with really big problems and trauma and anxiety and anger management. So if Eric is sitting with Mr. B at the Social Security building or at Income Support Division, trying to connect him to some basic services, oftentimes they walk. You have to wait 2 hours and they just leave. They can't put up with it.
Right.
Sometimes the challenge starts even before that. I mean, their capacity to really just be in work through a challenging process that, you know, of going, you know, going down, sitting. And so sometimes that concern starts before we even get in the car and go down there. Our belief, and is supported by studies, is that the trust and the willingness to push through that and the de-escalation of that anxiety will be assisted by the dog.
So let's talk about the dog. We are sitting here with this beautiful, what is it, golden Labrador retriever called Montauk, who has been trained by Assistance Dogs of the West. And I guess you were the primary person, Eric, working with the dog.
Yes.
Trained to do what? I mean, some assistance dogs do things like open cabinets for people who are handicapped. Some dogs can detect diabetes and other medical conditions. What is this dog trained to do?
Well, you know, with the inception of the idea as well as the execution, you know, we approached Southwest Care and they thought that, you know, our idea was a good idea to move forward. And Assistance Dogs of the West trains them from very young, from puppy stage on up. And in the beginning, they don't know where the dog will be placed, what capacities necessarily that the dog will need to have on a daily work basis. So they start with things like opening cabinets, picking up keys, getting their bowl, you know, getting used to stimulus that they're not necessarily comfortable with in the beginning, and working through challenges. So they can be anything from a courthouse dog, you know, working with a facility, to a crisis response dog, to working with that courthouse or individuals with challenges. So again, opening doors and cabinets. So they are taught with a multitude of skills, because again, they don't know where they're going to go in the beginning. And then I believe, I don't want to speak necessarily, you know, for ADW, but I believe then as a handler and dog are paired, then the dog's training is then focused towards the job that they will be actually doing.
Yeah, I talked to them once years ago, and they said something that was so interesting to me, which is that dogs have really different desires. Like some dogs want to serve in this way, and some dogs want to serve in a different way, just like people. I mean, one person wants to be an EMT and another person wants to be a violin player. I mean, you can't make them be something that they're not. And they had a dog that clearly wanted to be a law enforcement dog. And so how they know is another mystery. But anyway.
Well, and I, you know, with Montauk, I mean, he is a very grounding personality dog. You know, he loves interacting with people. He loves to meet new people, and in interacting with people, he is fulfilled. I mean, his tail's wagging. I mean, as you saw, total strangers came up today and he's like, who are you? And in that way, that's the personality trait that they're looking for as far as the work that he'll be doing in this capacity.
So the idea is, let's say that Mr. B has been passed out by the side of the road. He detoxes. It's time to go to Social Security, or it's time to go to an agency. There's a long wait. You take the dog, and it makes, like, what's the vision?
The vision is that the dog will be a stabilizing force for someone who's a grounding force. I mean, with petting a dog, you know, we have, you know, oxytocin, the connective chemical release, and the grounding that that offers with someone who, you know, for instance, self-medicates with alcohol, there, you know, that is a substance that kind of numbs us out. And so as they, you know, sober up and they start to, you know, interact with those feelings and emotions that they have been self-medicating with, that can become challenging to then perform a task. And so not only that is helping folks, you know, ground and feel connected, but also develop trust. So hopefully we've met him previous to this interaction, and Montauk has helped with the growing of a trusting relationship between the two of us, that I am there and the dog is there in his best interest. And, you know, we're not going to lie to him. We're not going to betray him.
Now, some people have dog phobias. Some people have dog allergies. Are you going to screen for that?
Well, I don't walk into a scene without assessing the scene first. So, for instance, we stage on some scenes before we go and provide medical care for Montauk. I go in and ensure the scene is safe for him to be there. So I ask clients their permission to have the dog, and also make sure that there's maybe nothing he's going to step on. There's no glass and so forth. So really assessing the situation beforehand, before bringing the dog directly in, is part of the protocol.
Are you concerned that people will call 911 just so they can see the dog?
That has actually not been a thought in my mind. I had actually never conceived that may be the case.
So the dog at this point, we have the Connect program, which sort of is the main thing that Eric works in, but we also do follow up on all opiate overdoses, and we do follow up on any firefighter can refer someone who they've been on a 911 call for who has unmet needs, and we'll follow up with them. So the dog at this point will be primarily involved in follow-up services, so not on 911 scenes.
Right.
So there is definitely some applications that we can explore whether a dog would be helpful on a scene. You could think of a particularly traumatic situation when someone has died and there's a really distraught family member. And I mean, it's a little touchy, but there may be some proper applications for 911 use, but that is definitely not where we're starting. We're starting with follow-up services to individuals we've identified who are vulnerable. And like Eric said, the goal is to have the dog help us build that trusting relationship to begin with. Like Eric said, before we started this interview, three people walked into this office and wanted to pet him.
Right.
So dogs have a little bit of a magnetic force. And if we can use that to build trusting relationships with the folks that we're helping in the community, that's all the better. So first is the trust. And then second of all is just the calming, soothing presence during stressful situations.
What is the role, Jeff Thomas, of Southwest Care in all of this?
Well, we've been involved with the MEHO program since its genesis, and I think Andres downplays his part in this because, you know, he was really the driver to develop this paradigm shift in how the fire department operates in the city and what role it fulfills. And we've been involved with that from the get-go. You know, we are a primary care provider, and we also provide some specialty services. We offer an integrated approach to primary care with behavioral health specialists at all of our clinics, case managers at all of our clinics. We have, obviously, physicians and nursing staff and other providers. And that integrated model fits really well with what these guys are establishing on the road. So it just made really good sense for us to be involved in that. When I heard what was being established in terms of a mobile response that was not just roll up in an ambulance, take vital signs, stabilize the patient, and drive them to the ER, which is what many emergency medical services do, and without any creative alternative, this was, you know, groundbreaking, and we felt that it was very important to support it from the beginning. and along with other partners. I don't want to sound like Southwest Care is the only medical provider in town involved in this. The folks at Christus and Presbyterian and PMS and La Familia, a lot of our community partners in the on the healthcare landscape are engaged in this. The opportunity to sponsor a dog for the program came up in a off-the-cuff conversation, and I brought it up with our board of directors, and they were enthusiastically supportive. And I can't wait to bring Montauk to a board meeting.
He will be the star of the meeting, no doubt. One of the things that I think is important to talk about, along with appropriate care, and perhaps this is part of appropriate care, is what the economic aspect of it is. In other words, are we saving the taxpayer, the premium payer money by providing appropriate care, sort of first responder and then ongoing?
Well, I see it absolutely as potentially, you know, saving the system a substantial amount of money. I also think it's a responsible thing to do to work with what are commonly referred to as the social determinants of health, homelessness, poverty, the access to social services and supportive services, so that they're not just going to the ER, getting discharged, and going back to the same set of conditions that perpetuates that Mr. B kind of phenomenon. I think there are just, you know, a myriad of opportunities that this program is addressing, and I can't wait to see where it goes next.
Do you have any success stories that have come from this, from providing that kind of really specific case management appropriate care that you'd like to share?
Yeah, there are many of them, but to answer your first question about the financial aspect, I like to think about it less as dollars and more as value. You know, we don't ask, does a fire engine save us money? We don't ask, does an ambulance save us money? It's an investment in public safety that has for a long time gone unexamined. It's just taken for granted. You just need it. The only reason you need a fire engine really is to protect life. That's the goal. If that is the number one goal of any incident, to protect life safety. And if our goal is to protect life safety, then we need to ask the question, what is threatening life safety in our community? And if what is threatening life safety is in our community are unintentional injury deaths for seniors from falls, which is the leading cause of death, the unintentional injury cause of death for seniors in our community, or if we have more overdose deaths than fire deaths, or if we have more suicide deaths than hazardous materials deaths, then if our goal is really to protect life safety, then we need to figure out what sort of value we're getting for an investment, our $22 million a year investment in our fire department. So I think it absolutely provides a very high value service when you examine it from that point of view. You do a community risk assessment, you figure out what's hurting people, what's harming lives and destroying lives, and then you design programs that are responsive to that need instead of to our idea of what the need may be.
The reason I ask the economic question is not because I think that should be the first. I mean, obviously providing services is what it's all about. But sometimes I think sending a fire truck and an ambulance for somebody who's fallen down is kind of like sending an 18-wheel truck to move a stick of butter.
If you're a contractor, it's like sending a cement mixer to bid out your jobs.
Right.
It's like sending electricians to do plumber's work. It doesn't matter how fast they can get there. If they don't have the tools, the training, the oversight, the support to do the job, then it doesn't matter if we have a 5-minute response time. But it also makes sense financially. Our healthcare system is going towards accountability, so with accountable care organizations. It's pushing risk, financial risk, more towards providers and going towards population health management models where individual providers are held accountable for outcomes instead of just doing more, instead of a higher volume of services, higher value in their services. So, you know, I'm not a statistician or a financial analyst or an expert in healthcare economics, but I can tell you that every single day we provide mediocre care at a really high cost through the emergency medical services system, which includes first response and the emergency room. So trying to get at the root causes, as Jeff said, of the social determinants of health. You know, when you have a diabetic who's homeless, who doesn't have a refrigerator to refrigerate his insulin, it's not a surprise that he's in the ER every 3 weeks with really high sugars. So the question of does it make financial sense, we need much more robust analytics than what we can do internally right now. So even though a lot of departments have come out with some preliminary data on financial savings, I think some of those analyses are a little premature. I think the sample sizes are small. I don't think that they've controlled for some factors. I mean, it gets fairly complicated. So instead of waiting to get clear answers on that, we're focusing on, you know, what sort of service, I live here in the city, what sort of service do I want my tax dollars to go towards? And it's responsive, mission-focused, data-driven services that are really responsive to community need.
So back to the question of success stories, what are some examples of people who might not have been helped by that expensive, mediocre care, but are helped by this newer model?
I can think of a particular example off the top of my head of an individual who called 911 for help with, I believe it was his mother, who was falling, just deteriorating health condition. The crews showed up, put her back into bed, and then one of our mobile integrated health paramedics showed up and asked if there was anything else we could do. And the individual who was taking care of his mother and was very overwhelmed said, I'm dealing with my own medical conditions. I just need some help. I'm trying to get her into a program. I think it starts with an H. I don't remember it. And the paramedic said, is it hospice? And he said, yeah, that's the thing. That's what I think we need. So she was quickly connected to hospice. A hospice nurse came out within a few days and obviously really helped the situation quite a bit. We have a certain individual, I can't get into too many details because of confidentiality, but a severely mentally ill woman who was living in extremely dangerous conditions and refusing appropriate care and seeking inappropriate care every 2 or 3 days. Her apartment was a fire risk. She was off of all the meds she needed. She was, without getting too graphic, she had a little space heater, which she used for heat, and she was essentially cooking her leg and getting repeated infections and just horrible care. And she was just getting discharged back into that old environment. And there were a lot of agencies involved, but nothing was really happening to get her to a better place. And through coordinating with all the system partners and her family, we were able to get essentially her family to start making healthcare decisions for her. And she's in a much better place now. She's getting the care that she needs. She's using healthcare appropriately, and she's much safer. She's not going to continue to live in squalor and be a fire risk to the entire apartment complex. There are many, many stories like that. We had an individual who came into town. He was on a wheelchair. I believe he was an amputee.
Double amputee.
And I think he called about 15 times in 2 weeks, or people called for him because he just looked so vulnerable out on a wheelchair on the middle of Surreal's Road, and his wheelchair would run out of batteries. And it was just this logistical nightmare. The wheelchair weighed like 2,000 pounds, and you'd have to put her in a vehicle to take it to the hospital with him. And the crews were frustrated that they weren't able to actually help him. They referred him to us, and along with the hospital, we worked to find out that he actually had concerned family in Colorado, and he had sort of wandered down here, and he wanted to be back in Colorado. His family wanted him back. So we didn't just ship him out to move the problem. We really got him reconnected with his support structures and got him home. And I mean, the stories are endless. There are so many like that. And for every success story, we don't take credit for them, because there are also some times when the system just doesn't work for people. And we just bear witness to how broken the system is and how little we can do to help them. But we at least take some comfort in knowing that we're doing our part, trying everything we can to make sure that their needs are met and that they're safe.
So back to the dog. First of all, when does the dog go actually on duty? He hasn't quite started yet?
Not yet. So the last week of September, he'll be fully done with training, and we'll plan to take him out to the places that I would typically go just to get him acclimatized to the environment that he will be working with.
You're part of that training already?
Yes. Yes, so I have been working with ADW since, it's almost been a full year in training with them, and there's one final step, you know, the week of the 17th, and then we will, in a sense, go live. We work on a quarterly basis. October 1 will be the start of a new quarter, so that will be the time at which he first starts working with clients.
Do you see any clients who might be candidates for assistance dogs themselves?
Yes, and they actually tend to be folks that have either are severe diabetics or have seizure disorders. So one of the, because they are trained to smell the chemical precursors to those events.
Right.
So I could definitely see some of our clients benefiting from dogs from Assistance Dogs of the West.
I was looking up assistance dogs and firehouses and first responders, and one of the things that I found was some fairly new programs in which they use assistance dogs for first responders because you guys get so traumatized by the work you do. Does this dog have a role to play in that capacity?
Well, while that's not the primary focus of the dog's duties, that yes, to echo Jeff's comments earlier about Assistance Dogs of the West and training a couple of dogs for as crisis response canines for the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the FBI agents actually speak to the secondary benefit for their personnel, in addition to being a benefit for the people that the dogs are there to work with primarily. Definitely our office will benefit from having Montauk just around the office space because we do stressful work and it's hard on us all. And to have someone there who's just relaxed and happy to see you is a good thing to come home to.
This is really a pilot. Chief Litzenberg, now City Manager Litzenberg, wanted to see something like this tried out. He thought that mobile integrated health was a good place to start, and Southwest Care Center was generous enough to help fund the acquisition of the dog. But it's really a pilot. I mean, it's starting with this really vulnerable population, but whether it's working with the first responders or going on specific 911 calls or being deployed to big disasters, those are all sort of open questions, open conversations. And we know that there is a ton of potential. And essentially, any time that there's interaction, human-to-human interaction, dogs can sort of be the grease to make those interactions better and more effective and efficient. So yeah, we're approaching this pilot with an open mind and seeing where it goes.
I wanted to ask you all before we go, I mean, you've all talked about the things that are broken in the system or not working as well as they could or places where there are just huge gaps and inefficiencies. And then, when I hear things like the risk is being pushed back on providers, that's a little scary too. If each of you could kind of wave your magic wand and make the system work better, perhaps based on models that you've seen elsewhere or ideas that have been talked about, what would you do?
Well, first of all, as to the risk of putting that pressure on the providers, it's a very gradual movement in terms of value-based payments where we will be compensated, as Andres referred to, for health outcomes. And that's been going on for years, that movement. It's taken hold in some communities more so than others. Here in New Mexico, I think it's on a very fairly slow pace. And that's actually in response to an effort to address three factors that were identified by the Institute for Health Improvement. They're a big group out of Orlando. And that was, they called it the triple aim, that we want to improve health outcomes for our patients. We want to increase efficiencies, which gets us back to the cost of healthcare delivery. If we're more efficient and improving healthcare costs, efficiencies, then thirdly, the third part of the triple aim was to enhance the patient experience. So when I think of this program, the MIHO program is actually affecting all of that. It's doing what it can to improve health outcomes. It's doing what it can to increase efficiencies and reduce those exorbitant costs of emergency medical services. And it's clearly enhancing the patient experience. Montauk's going to be a phenomenal enhancement. As for the magic wand, I tend to shy away from those kinds of hypotheticals. I think we're doing everything we can with the resources we have and the systems that exist, and we just try and find ways to continue to improve their, in this case, interoperability.
Interoperability.
Mm. I think one of the big barriers is stigma. So getting rid of stigma would be big.
What do you mean by getting rid of stigma?
So when Mr. B shows up and he's half drunk, and he's there for his medical appointment, and he's there 30 minutes late, typically that's well, you know, he doesn't have any personal accountability and he's drunk and he obviously doesn't care. Kick him out of here and, you know, get him, essentially fire him. It's a moral failure. He's a bad person. He's not like us good people that can show up sober, clean, and on time for appointments. And that doesn't take into account his mental health issues. It doesn't really value it as much. I mean, think of it, to give you a really concrete example, imagine a medical practice that is on a second floor and has stairs, and some patients have wheelchairs and they just can't, there's no way they're going to be able to make it up those stairs. It's an impossible barrier. And then if that practice then judged those people and said, well, they obviously don't want our services. They don't want our help. So we don't need to help them. That's what happens with mental health all the time. You know, you have someone who's struggling. We all struggle with mental health. So, but you have people that are really struggling with mental health and substance abuse. And oftentimes those go together. So it's really difficult for them to get services. When they show up late, instead of saying, wow, they showed up late, you should say, wow, they actually made it all the way here. They don't have a car. They have an infected foot. They have no money. They were afraid to get killed on the railroad tracks last night by the three guys camping down the tracks from them. I can't believe they're even here today. Wow, let's seize this moment. Let's take an opportunity to try to provide this person good services. So I think reducing stigma, just understanding how much mental health affects everyone, integrating mental health and physical health services. So Southwest Care Center, Jeff mentioned having mental health and physical health under the same roof. That's super, super important. And I mean, a national, we're the only industrialized nation in the world that doesn't have some sort of national health system. The profits that are in the system are enormous. You know, having third-party payers and middlemen and insurance adjusters and the administrative cost of all that is enormous. That could be going towards providing good care. So like Jeff, I shy away from some sort of magic wand solution because I don't know how the system would be designed. It's extremely complicated. Healthcare is a fifth of our GDP. It's an enormous part of our economy. So there are interests in there and there's, you know, there's a lot to be fixed. But I think being more patient-centered, be more integrated with mental health and physical health, reducing stigma. And what the Fed is trying to do is clear up the incentives and put the financial incentives in the right place where you value outcomes instead of just increased volume of services is a really broad sort of schema that that I would propose.
Well, and I just wanted to say in response to one of the things you were talking about with our hypothetical Mr. B, there's so many people with mental health issues incarcerated and the services there are sometimes either non-existent or so detrimental to the patient that that's another piece of it. Eric, what about you?
Well, I would echo the sentiments of both Andres and Jeff, and only to add, you know, housing resources. If we had smoother and quicker abilities to house folks that had experienced long-term homelessness or that were about to experience homelessness, that tend to be more vulnerable families, you know, groups with kids, but also the integration, again, to echo, of medical and behavioral health and having more resources with that capacity.
Yeah, to go to housing, Mr. B, it's easy for us to get CAT scan after MRI paid for, but we can't get his housing paid for. We can't get him off the street.
And when you think about what an MRI costs, it would be great to be able to put that money toward a down payment on an apartment.
Yeah, I mean, that would be a year's worth of rent.
Yeah. Well, much more to be talked about, and we hope to follow up this topic in future programs. I want to thank you all so much for being here, Andres Mercado and Eric Hickey from the Mobile Integrated Health Office in the City of Santa Fe Fire Department, and Jeff Thomas, Executive Director of Southwest Care here in Santa Fe. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And we're going to post a picture of all of you and Montauk at radiocafe.org. You've been listening to The Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. This program is brought to you in part by Dotfoil Computer Services, providing computer repair and business services for Apple and PC. They're Santa Fe's only Apple-authorized service provider. You can find them on the web at dotfoil.com and in the Candyman Center in Santa Fe. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send any feedback on the show, ideas, or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.